The American dream, we often talk about it this way, as the self-made man or woman, perspiration over inspiration. And then, of course, there's the idea of bootstraps, that we pull ourselves up as rugged individuals. Well, our next guest says the idea of the self-made person is a bit of a fiction. Alyssa Quart is author of the book Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. She's a journalist and executive director of a nonprofit called the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Alyssa, hello.
Hello, Scott.
Let me ask you about boots, literal boots. You've written about this. And as you write, pulling yourself up actually is not a physical thing, is it?
No. So boots were really important in the 19th century. Wealthier people sometimes had people help them put their boots on, or they had little contraptions to help them put their boots on. But for a working man, it was a struggle to pull them up, just to get them on their feet. Over time, there became this sort of joke, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, as if that would be possible. Back then, it was a joke, and it was a way to like mock people, actually. In 19th century newspaper articles, they'd mock an inventor. Oh, he pulled himself up by his bootstraps. And then over time, it became something that people took really seriously.
Much of your book delves into this long history and power of the idea, the rags to riches stories that Horatio Alger penned, the writings of Henry David Thoreau on self-sufficiency. How do these cultural references over time kind of reinforce this idea, which you argue is a myth?
Yeah, so I love Emerson and Thoreau. There was a lot of beauty in their ideas of individualism, but they also were somewhat punishing when they themselves were, you know, socializing. They had often lived on inherited money, and they were in community with one another. You know, and they often had a wife cleaning their house top to bottom and inherited money from families, right? And then with Horatio Alger, it's even more complicated because he wrote these novels that were supposedly rags to riches novels. And there were stories of teenagers who grew up in poverty. They had titles like Paul the Peddler. And then they'd meet a wealthy man who would save them. So the story really wasn't about this hard work and this grit and this luck and pluck only. It was about being rescued by a benefactor. So it was weird that then that became this Horatio Alger story where no one helps anybody and you're just supposed to survive on your own. And then I looked into Horatio Alger, and he actually had been a minister in Brewster, Massachusetts, and he'd been chased out of the church for pedophilic acts.
So people kind of making the argument for this self-made person idea, as you look into it, they're not exactly the self-made people. But what about the idea? In your view, when you look into the history, when you look into the evidence, what is the problem with this idea?
What's wrong with it is it's not true. I say frequently that if you think you're self-made, call your mother. We come from people. We are living in a society, we attend schools, we drive on roads that somebody else made, we drink water that hopefully, at least in some places, has been purified by our infrastructure. We are creatures that are not just interdependent, but profoundly dependent.
You use the term toxic mythology. As we've been saying, this idea of hard work, grit is this aspiration, and we hear about it in all walks of life. In your view, can it actually be damaging to people who, I don't know, subscribe to this, pay too much attention to this idea?
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw a lot of people who blame themselves for not being able to achieve this American dream, that they had gone to college and graduate school, they'd gotten certificates, they'd invested in their families, they tried to own homes, and somehow none of it had worked out. And I think that the mythology was part of why I wrote this, because I wanted to understand what drove some of these people, you know, to these levels of self-hatred and self-blame, when it was clear to me that there was no longer a market for what they were selling, or that, you know, brain work had become gig work, and there was just not going to be a way that they were going to be able to equal their parents in terms of earning power.
So this idea of bootstrapped is at least connected to, you know, what many people call meritocracy. Right, that the track team position goes to the fastest runner, or the elite college spots go to the kids with the top SATs and the GPAs. And you know, the argument is that's how we're going to find the next person who's going to find a cure for cancer. Are you suggesting we kind of question that system?
I definitely think we should question that system, but I also would question whether it's actually the most talented people who are getting those breaks. I mean, I think if we look at some of the numbers around mobility, they used to be, you know, you had a 92% chance of exceeding your parents in terms of mobility if you were born in the 40s. And now it's, if you were born in the 80s, you had a 50% chance. So you look at that and you're like, does that mean that people were more talented in the 1940s? This isn't to say that there aren't people who are more talented than others. I mean, I think there is innate ability. I do. And there is a capacity for perseverance in some that others don't have. Like, I don't dispute that, but I'm not sure that the bootstrapped story is necessarily really about talent. I think it's often about justifying already privileged people's good luck as luck. It's people like Donald Trump or Elon Musk saying that it's somehow natural that they would have all the more breaks and all the more power because they say things like that they're self-made or that they were not subsidized by their governments, which they were.
Mm-hmm. You're right about GoFundMe campaigns for funerals, for medical procedures we've all given to those kinds of things. You call these dystopic social services. What do you mean?
Yes, I call it the dystopian social safety net. These are services that it's great that they exist. I mean, it's very moving when you get requests to fund an ill friend and you see the thousands of dollars rolling in from friends and sometimes strangers. You're like, this is beautiful. This is part of what it means to be human. But it's also really tragic. And I call it the dystopian social safety net because these are things that shouldn't be things that are in the nonprofit sphere. They shouldn't be handled by a ragtag team of volunteers and NGOs and, you know, Instacart workers that were performing the tasks of social service workers, you know, bringing food to people who were disabled. And so all this beauty is at the same time kind of a tragic beauty. I mean, I met people who were raising maternity leave days for their colleague. They were like contributing their sick days. And that's a dystopian social safety net. Yeah.
Mm. Which takes us to solutions. And briefly, you know, you write in your book, Alyssa, we have a lot to learn from the pandemic in terms of seeing the value of collective support. When you think about society-wide solutions, you know, what comes to mind? Do you have an example or two that you're suggesting?
So things like the mutual aids that I talked about that rose up during the pandemic where people would help neighbors. It was a new kind of charity. It wasn't top down. It wasn't just, you know, kind of noblesse oblige giving. It was people giving to one another potentially to become recipients. So it would be kind of a more reciprocal charity, if you will. Workers' cooperatives. So I spent a lot of time talking to people at workers' cooperatives. That means workers who own their own companies and their own labor, and they're doing that in the digital space as well. I talked to people who are doing participatory budgeting, which are groups that work with local governments and try to allocate resources to local parks and so forth. There's so many of these community kind of arrangements, some of which were quite new and some of which were quite old. And I was very excited by them and by the spirit within them, the kind of collective joy. And that brings me to the last point that, you know, some of the things that gave me hope were the different ways of thinking about ourselves, to think of ourselves less as creatures of this fake Horatio Alger story, but more of, you know, collective possibility, communal joy.
Just to make sure I understand, you're arguing that in some cases, this collective action is the job of government, yeah?
Absolutely. And I think we need to see more of that. And there's a few things that gave me hope around that. And they included some of the actions our government took during the pandemic, the eviction moratorium, child tax credit. Also, people were no longer being thrown off the Medicaid and SNAP rolls, you know, because they weren't able to go in and have these interviews where they were considered worthy of the getting any assistance from the government. So I think these were moments that we could extend and we should extend keeping this alive.
We have been talking to Alyssa Quart. Her book is Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa Quart, great to talk to you. Congratulations on the book. Thanks so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.